know that there have been, it's not funny that, it's just a little bit, I suppose, but we know that there have been, it's not funny, but their quarantine at the school now is going to just kind of bleed over into quarantine here. The people that can't go back to school can't come here either, and I'm thankful that we're all being faithful to that, at least to avoid exposing other people here who, well, we don't want them to catch things here and then take it back to school, and so we try to streamline things as we go, so thank you for that. Second thing about all of this is that we are memorizing. I don't know how many of you know that. Not going to start asking for a show of hands just yet, but we're memorizing Psalm 23. Find a translation that sings to you and memorize the passage. I know that several already have it memorized. I know that some already had it memorized before we started talking like that, but whichever applies to you, if you maybe you think you're too old to memorize. No, you're not. Trust me on that. You're not too old to memorize. We had that small that group this morning, you know, where we're making God's story my story, and they asked us to introduce ourselves just because it's the first time out, and so I heard, and they wanted to know how long you've been following Jesus, and how long you've been going to church here, and so when I introduced myself, that was the moment that it hit me that it's 60 years this fall since I made the decision to follow Jesus. And as I sat there and thought about that and sat there and said that and then sang that song with you this morning, all my life you have been faithful. All my life you have been good. It's true. It's absolutely true. And so I guess I'm just trying to say that if I'm not too old to memorize, then certainly you are not too old to memorize. So give yourself the gift of Psalm 23 for Christmas. December 6th is the deadline, but you'll still probably be able to remember it at Christmas time. At least I hope, unless you cram. That's the only way that you wouldn't remember it that far along. We've been working our way through Psalm 23 in a series entitled Because the Lord is My Shepherd. This is the fourth Sunday that we've been looking at Psalm 23, and the title for this morning is Because the Lord is My Shepherd, I Ease the Burdens of the Sheep. In the last message, I told you the story of Hagar, the slave girl that belonged to Sarah, Abraham and Sarah, and how amazed and thrilled she was that the God of all the universe saw her and listened to her. She was amazed that he would take the time to be aware of her needs, but she was also, I think, caught off guard by the fact that God moved to meet her needs, that God actually reached out and met her needs. And we made the point that the two of those things belong together whenever we're shepherding the heart of another person. We have to make a point of being aware of their needs, but we must also make a point of finding a way to meet those needs. And so the first principle of shepherding comes from Psalm 23:1, which says, Because the Lord is my shepherd, I have everything I need. And from that, we drew the first principle of shepherding. If I'm a shepherd, it's because I'm aware of the needs of the sheep and seek to meet them. And in that light, we talked about managing and planning. I hope you remember that as we reach out to other people. We said that we need to be planning the next phase of any endeavor, the next phase or stage of growth, at the same time that we're managing the present stage. In other words, when our children are toddlers, we need to manage that, as unmanageable as that may seem, but we also need to plan for when they start school and the changes they'll need to make. While we're there in school, we need to manage that, but then we need to plan for the time when they're done with school, the days that lie ahead, when they're finished with school, and it comes up quicker than you can possibly imagine if you haven't been through it. We need to work diligently at every phase and constantly ask the question, what if this works? What if this thing that we're trying with our child works? What's next? What if this thing that we're trying in our church works? What's next? What, instead of asking ourselves, well, when this fails, what are we going to do then? No, don't do that. What if this works? What if God steps up like God is inclined to do? What if we succeed at this? What happens next? Because a true shepherd is not content only to help people feel better when they fail. A true shepherd is constantly looking for ways to help the sheep to succeed, the people that are under his care. The true shepherd is constantly asking the question, is this issue that this person is facing something that's going to naturally go away? Most things don't. But is this something that's going to naturally go away, or is it something that will be even more difficult in the next stage? If a child is overwhelmed in kindergarten, what's going to happen in eighth grade? And what adjustments do you need to make as a mom and dad to help your child succeed in the future? Jeremiah 12:5 says, if you've raced with men on foot and they have worn you out, how can you compete with horses? If you stumble in safe country, level ground, how will you manage in the thickets by the Jordan? We need to be aware that when a brother or sister needs to be rescued and we need to step in and rescue them, and as we manage the situation, that's what managing it looks like, rescuing the ones that need to be rescued. But we also need to plan. Even as we're stepping into rescue, we need to plan with them how they themselves can get to a place where they're able to manage their situation with God's help. Because this is where all shepherding begins. It all starts with listening to other people's hearts instead of simply monitoring their behavior. It's impossible to help anyone deal with the issues in their life without first listening to them. It's impossible to help another person solve a problem of which you are unaware. You know, we stand here on a Sunday morning and we look around and we see that guy over there, he's just not worshiping, right? He's standing and he's scowling, and he's just not worshiping. He obviously doesn't have a heart of worship, right? Maybe that's not it. Maybe he got some news this morning that he didn't expect, and maybe his heart is broken right now. We don't know that. You can't help anyone if you don't understand what that person is facing. Now, we said all along that true shepherding begins with listening. And when we say that, we need to be clear that true shepherding begins with listening, but true shepherding never ends with listening, with simply listening. There's more to it than that. Because that's because people feel better when they're listened to. Do you? I know I do. When I've been listened to, I feel better. But think about this. If I'm talking to someone perhaps in my office or you know, over lunch, and they're in the midst of difficulties that are overwhelming them, difficulties that are too much for them, they're going to feel better if I just sit and listen to them. It's a great relief to be able to download something like that. So if they're overwhelmed by difficulties and I listen to them and they feel better, that's a good thing. And I've been helpful. But what's going to happen the next time overwhelming difficulties come up in their lives? What's going to happen the next time they get to the place where they're overwhelmed because of what's going on in their life in the future? But here's the tipping point for me. I listened to their overwhelming difficulties, but I didn't help them learn how to thrive. And in the midst of the difficulties that they're facing right now, they don't have that skill in their life. It's already overwhelmed them. They came into my office overwhelmed, or they came to lunch already overwhelmed by things that are going on right now. And that means that they're going to walk away from the conversation still burdened by the difficulties that have overwhelmed them up until that point. And how long do you suppose it's going to be before they're once again so overwhelmed by their present difficulties that they can no longer function? It's going to be just a few minutes after they leave, after the conversation ends, because it was great that I listened to them, but if I didn't help them to thrive, if I didn't help them to deal with situations like that, then I haven't helped them really. So shepherding starts with listening, but there's more to shepherding than that, and we're going to let David walk us through, King David, the shepherd of Israel, walk us through all that in the weeks that lie ahead. And so let's remind ourselves of another thing that we saw last week. David expected a certain quality of life because he was being shepherded by God. Psalm 23 is at its heart a description of how a good shepherd takes care of the sheep. As we shepherd and care for other people, we represent him, the good shepherd. So our shepherding should be, we noted this last week, our shepherding should be a reflection of his shepherding in our lives. Whether we're talking about our spouse or our children or the kids at school or friends or office co-workers at work, no matter who we're talking about, our shepherding in their lives should be a reflection of his. And Psalm 23 has a great deal to offer that could instruct us about the heart of God, about the way God shepherds and how we can then relate to people that God's placed under our care. It's okay for any of us. In fact, it's okay for all of us not to be okay. It's okay for us to be needy, but it's not okay to not have shepherds in our midst who can meet those needs. And so it's time to get back to Psalm 23. And once again, I want you to think of this passage of Scripture in terms of the story that lies behind it. David has become the shepherd of Israel, but he was once a young man who took care of sheep before he met Goliath that day. He's the shepherd of Israel, and he was thinking one day about all that he had to do as he shepherded the sheep, all the demands that were on him as he took care of this group of animals that couldn't take care of themselves. And in his mind's eye, he began to picture how God related to him and how closely the way he cared for those sheep mirrored the way God cared for him in his personal life. And so he took up his lyre, which is not a person who doesn't tell, it's a musical instrument. He took up his lyre and a pen and a parchment, a quill and a parchment, and he wrote a song. So once again this week, I'll ask you to put on your shepherd's cloak and sandals, and if you have to, close your eyes as you listen to the 23rd Psalm. Because the Lord is my shepherd, I have everything I need. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. And even though I walk through the dark valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, because you are with me. Your rod and your staff comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely your goodness and your love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. The story from God's Word that I want to tell you this week comes from the book of Matthew, chapter 11, and it's about something that happened at the end of a very difficult conversation that Jesus was having with the people who were gathered around him there in that place that he was teaching. But to be clear, it wasn't the ordinary people that were there in the crowd that day that were making the conversation difficult. It was the Pharisees and the members of the Sanhedrin. In other words, the religious people were making those conversations difficult. Jesus just wanted to tell the common people the simple truth. That's all he wanted to do. But the religious people were complicating Jesus' simple truth by twisting Jesus' words to fit into their own religion. That's what they were doing. Jesus, of course, in response to that, had the right to remain silent, like we all do. But remaining silent was never the way that Jesus chose to react to situations like that. Jesus was a true shepherd. So he wasn't content with letting sheep, his sheep, carry burdens on their back that the religious shepherds had placed there. So as I tell the story, be listening to what Jesus said to the people on that hillside that day to ease the burden of the sheep. And with that background, this is the story from God's Word from Matthew chapter 11, verses 25 to 30. Jesus had been leading and teaching and preaching in the villages there in Israel, and everywhere he went, he was forced to deal with the objections and unbelief of the religious authorities. Jesus put up with all that opposition for a time, and then he did something, well, different. He began to pray out loud while the group was gathered there around him. And in this paraphrase, this is how he prayed. Thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth. Thank you for concealing your ways and your truth from these super educated and highly learned men and these people that think they're wise. And thank you for revealing your ways and your truth to ordinary people. These ordinary people that surround me, these people that are as inexperienced as little children. Thank you, Father, that this is the way that you always choose to do things. This is the way you like to work. Jesus then resumed talking to the ordinary people and told them, the Father has given me truth and insight. And it is the truth that the Father has given me that motivates me to do the things that I do and to say the things that I say. and you've seen and heard me. Jesus then went on to say that everything he said and did grew from the unique relationship that he had with the Father, that he enjoyed with the Father. He added, he said to the ordinary people, you see, the religious people in this group don't know the Father, don't know me the way the Father knows me, his only Son. And beyond that, these religious people, these super learned people, will never get to know the Father in the way that you will know the Father. You ordinary people will know the Father as you listen to me, as you follow me. And then Jesus said the most beautiful thing of all to that group of ordinary people that day. Aren't you tired of all this? Aren't you worn out and burned out by all the burdens that these others are making you carry, these religious burdens that are strapped onto your backs? If you are, then come close to me, and I'll teach you to do life the way I do life, because I'm gentle and humble at heart. And if you come away with me and follow me, I promise that at long last, you'll find rest for your souls. Because unlike the religious authorities, my way of doing life is easy. And the burdens that I will ask you to carry are light. And that's the story from God's word. Psalm 23, 2 and 3 says, he makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. I want you to think for a minute about what Jesus said on that hillside that day. He literally said, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. When Jesus talked about his yoke, he's not talking about something that oxen would carry. He's speaking like a rabbi. And in the Jewish tradition, God gave every rabbi a yoke to carry. They were the result of his studies. A rabbi's yoke was made up of the truth that God had revealed to him, and that was combined with all the things that the rabbi believed. And the rabbi always chose to live in keeping with the truth that he understood and believed, and that's what made him a rabbi. Now, every rabbi was different in the scope of things that they knew and the scope of things that they believed and understood, and that means that every rabbi was slightly different from other rabbis in the way that he lived. And that day on that hillside, Jesus was inviting us, to take on his yoke. In other words, he wants us to understand what he understood. He wants us to believe what he believed, and he wants us to do life the way he did life. And it's in that context that Jesus says the most amazing thing. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. In other words, Jesus is saying that he wants us to come away with him, to follow him out of the midst of the mess. And he's promising that when we learn to do life the way he does life, the way he does life is easy. And the yoke that, the burden that he'll put on our shoulders is light. That's what he says. And I'm wondering if that has been your experience as you followed Jesus. Is the way that you do life easy? Are the burdens that you are carrying light? If not, is Jesus just making a promise here that he never intended to keep? Or if your life is not easy, is it possible that you're not living life the way that Jesus has taught you to live life? If the burdens that you're carrying are not light, is it possible that you're carrying burdens that Jesus never intended you to carry? If either of those are the case, then I'd say this, join the club. Join the club. I want to tell you about a time when I refused the rest that Jesus was offering. He was clearly offering me rest in this situation, and I wouldn't accept it, and I insisted. I insisted on carrying burdens that he wanted to carry for me. And I've told some of you some of the parts of the story that I'm about to tell, but I wanted you to hear the whole thing this morning in the context of the burdens we needlessly carry. Way back in the early days of our trying to build economy, among the Bukolot. This goes back several years now, 2009, 2010. I was up in the northern part of Bukolot territory and discovered a corn cartel, of all things, down in the lowlands that surrounded Bukolot territory. It was a true cartel. There were businessmen in the lowlands who offered loans, offered to loan money to the Bukolot farmers so that they'd be able to buy seed and fertilizer to grow corn. The idea was that the Bukolot would borrow the money from the cartel and use it to buy seed and fertilizer and then grow the corn, and they would buy the seed and fertilizer from the same people who had loaned them the money. So the money went out to come back to the same people for seed and fertilizer. And then they would grow the corn and sell their crop to the same people who had loaned them the money, and they would use the profit then, the profit, in quotes, to pay back the loan. And it might have worked famously, but the people who loaned the money never, ever paid a fair price for the harvest, never paid a fair price for the crop. And because of that, the people of the Bukolot were never able to pay off their debts. In fact, they were in debt for thousands of dollars, which for them is equal to millions for us. There was no way that they would ever find their way out of their debt. The amount of their indebtedness grew, and they were at a point where they would never get out of debt. And as we were having this meeting, there were 70 or so people in the room, church leaders and otherwise, and I asked for a show of hands how many of you are in debt, and every hand in the room went up. Every hand. So I suggested that we form a co-op that would enable them to pool their resources and buy seed and corn and fertilizer at a fair price without borrowing money. And then they could then sell that combined crop to someone who would be willing to pay a fair price for it, or maybe even cut out the middleman completely. We had a chalkboard up there, and I was writing furiously with chalk, and I fleshed out the idea for them. And then someone in the back row way back there spoke up, put his hand up, and said, stood up and said, "Is someone going to tell him? Because if no one's going to tell him, I'm going to tell him." Yeah. Well, you know, I was going to try to ignore that, but it just didn't seem wise. So I said, tell me what? "I'm going to tell you," he said, "that the corn cartel has made it very clear that no one will ever form a co-op up here. And if anyone tries, the cartel will do anything they need to do," that's the way he said it, "to keep that from happening." He nodded when he said that. You know, it was one of those, when a Bukolot moves his head like that, he nodded when he said it, when he said that, to make it clear that they were willing to do anything. They meant it when they said anything. Came up at the end of the meeting and reinforced the idea by telling me that if the co-op down in the lowlands, and we had to drive through that area in order to get into the foothills and up into the mountains, he came at the end of the meeting and told me that if the co-op or the cartel down there were to see me coming through the lowlands, that they would shoot me as I went by. And so I knew we'd have to drive fast, but all I could think of at that point was where am I going to find an attorney who'd be willing to be shot at while he's helping me form the co-op? I mean, really, that was all that we were thinking about. Of course, I was concerned about this threat, but God led me to an attorney down in Manila. I still remember meeting him. He was part Johnny Cochran, part John Wayne, and he was willing to go up with me. Even I said, "They might shoot at us." And he said, "Well, then we have to make the co-op bulletproof." I said, "Well, okay, but the van isn't." And, you know, we had a small conversation about that. But we made our way up there in the four-wheel drive van. And as we were cresting one of the hills on the way up into the mountains, and the people that have been there can tell you how steep those mountains are, you know, and how windy those roads are. But as we were cresting one of the hills there on the way up, I put my foot on the brake to slow us down, you know, as we started to make our descent, and my foot went right, literally made that noise, went right to the floor. The van didn't slow down at all. And so I as I pushed the brake and my foot went to the floor, and now we have no brakes, I turned to my friend, John Wayne, and I said, "I have no brakes." And he sat there and went, "Woohoo!" And I said, "No, really, I have no brakes." He said, "Oh," you know, he sobered up real quickly. He thought I was just having fun. I'm going this fast because I don't want to slow. No, it wasn't. Anyway, I'm serious. I got no brakes. And we shot down that two-rut track, with, 400 or 500 feet worth of drop-off, sheer drop-off there on the side, that two-rut track until we got to the bottom, and then we flew up the other side, you know, like a marble in one of those, flew up the other side like a water, and then we, you know, we did this back and forth until the thing finally stopped. And, we carefully got out. The road was that narrow. And we walked a little further into the mountains and met the Bukolot men there, and the men that were going to work with the attorney in forming the co-op. I got him settled there, and then I made my way back to the vehicle and very, very carefully, and that one-lane road, turned it around using the well-known 124-point turn. And now, I've made my way back up to the top of the mountain, and I'm thinking to myself, how am I going to get from here down there with no brakes, because it's just all downhill from here, which sounds like a good thing, but on that day it wasn't. I decided that what I'd do is lock the hubs. You know, I get out and lock the hubs, and by the way, the emergency brake wasn't working either. I locked the, of course, but I locked the hubs and I put it in four low, and I just kind of started down the mountain with one hand on the steering wheel and the other hand on the door handle, and that's the way I was making progress as I went down. And Faith, of all things, chose that moment to call from the States. So my cell phone rang, and I wasn't sure what to do, which I figured letting go of the door handle was slightly safer than letting go of the steering wheel, so I switched hands, and I picked up my phone, and she wanted to know, of course, hey, what you doing? And I said, well, it's like this. And I explained to her what I just explained to you. And I said, I'm going slow, but if I lose control, I'll just throw the phone onto the floor, because if it starts to go over the edge, I'll just jump out. And she wasn't too excited about my plan for some reason. You know, she's like that. But we actually finished the conversation, didn't have to throw the phone, and I wound my way down slowly down that mountain, thinking that if anyone was planning to ambush me, I was providing them with a very slow-moving target. I wasn't a sitting duck, but almost. I finally reached level ground, and I started across the flat plain, and now I'm looking for a place where I might be able to get it stopped, where they could actually fix the brakes. And I pulled it into this place, and they said, yeah, we can fix them, and they fixed it. It took a day and a half, but when I went back finally and picked up the vehicle and tested the brakes, they actually stopped the vehicle from rolling when it was, and, you know, modern technology. And I drove back up the mountain and hiked to where the attorney was still working, and by the end of that day, we had a co-op formed. Late that afternoon, we started back down the mountain, this time with brakes, and we were able to go a little faster, and we made it down into the lowlands safely. And the brakes were still working as we passed the place I told the attorney. That's where they fixed them, you know. We are so thankful to those guys. And then finally it started to get dark, and I settled in for a night-long ride because I was supposed to head straight to Manila. And once I got to Manila, I was supposed to head for a breakfast appointment. And then right from the breakfast appointment, I was supposed to go to the airport to catch a plane to Singapore, from which I would return here to the States. I know this is a long and complicated story. I do try to keep up. I didn't know it at the time, but the repair shop, you know, as I just settled in for that night-long drive, the repair shop had installed a brake line that was too long. And it's kind of funny the way I discovered that. I was coming into a corner a little too fast, like you do sometimes, because I was in a bit of a hurry. And I put my foot on the brake to slow down, and again, no more brakes. They just right. Apparently, the tire had worn through the brake line because it was leaning against the tire. And once again, we had no brakes, and we weren't in the mountains, but it was dark. And those of you who have ridden places in the Philippines know that people have a tendency to just pull out in front of you. And I knew I wasn't going to be able to get this thing stopped. And I shifted down and got the van to stop and got out and locked the hubs again and got into four low. And well, that's how we made our way, so that when I took my foot off the accelerator, it would actually slow the vehicle. And we were trying to make it to the little town of Cordon. Most of you, I don't think any of you have been there, but we were trying to make it to the little town of Cordon where we might be able to get a bus, a night bus to Manila. And perhaps this is where I should point out that my stress level at that point was relatively high. In other words, my life was not feeling easy, and my burdens weren't feeling light. We went slow, and about an hour later, we got to Cordon, where I had some difficulty stopping in the parking space there at the gas station. But we were now in this little gas station that had a little coffee area and just a little tiny town up there. I went inside, and I spoke to the manager, and he gave me permission to leave the vehicle there so that Steve, my son-in-law, could come back up in a few days and pick up the vehicle to go and get it worked on again. And then I asked him if there were any buses, night buses, that would pass this way. And he said, no, you can't get the bus here. You have to walk about a kilometer and a half, a couple of kilometers, it was a mile and a half or so back in that direction because the buses don't stop here at the gas station, he said. And so, if you just get your stuff and walk back there, you'll be able to catch a bus. I looked at my watch, and given the fact that we had to walk to the bus stop and then wait for the bus to show up, and then a bus that had room for us to show up, and then get on the bus with all our gear, I couldn't imagine that we'd make it for my breakfast appointment or for my flight to Singapore, and my stress ratcheted up a little more, even though I didn't think it could. Easy and light? I don't think so. Now, this is the point that you may find hard to believe, because I don't want to say that I heard an audible voice there in that completely Tagalog-speaking area. I don't want to say that I heard an audible voice at that moment, but in my head and in my heart, I clearly heard God's voice say, Jay, I got this. Jay, I got this. Those exact words. I'm ashamed to say it, but I brushed it off because it sounded like God was trying to tell me that he was in control. But I reminded myself that he had been in control all along, and that was the very thing that had gotten us into the mess that we were in at that moment. So I went to the other side of the gas station, and I told the attorney that we'd have to walk a couple of kilometers to the bus stop because no buses stopped at that station there. And I asked him if I could buy him a cup of coffee, and he's Filipino, so he said yes. That's just the way we do it over there. He was happy to let me buy him a cup of coffee. I bought him a cup of coffee, and I handed it to him, and then I bought one for myself. And I was standing there at the counter in this little tiny gas station, little tiny coffee shop in a tiny gas station way up north in Cordon in the Philippines, where there really aren't that many English speakers. And that was the moment that I noticed that there was music playing over the speakers above my head there in that little coffee shop. And remarkably, it was a song in English that was playing over the speakers. In fact, it was a hymn, an old hymn of all things, in English. It was a hymn that I had known since I was a child. I stopped stirring my coffee and stood there with my mouth open as the second verse of that hymn began to play at that very second. Though Satan should buffet, though trials should come, let this blessed assurance control that Christ has regarded my helpless estate and has shed his own blood for my soul. It is well. It is well with my soul. And I heard it again. Jay, I got this. I got this. Finished our coffee and walked through the doors of the gas station with all our gear in hand to start walking to the bus stop. And literally, as we stepped out the doors of that gas station, a huge air-conditioned bus pulled in and stopped in that parking lot. That very parking lot. Easy and light? Well, maybe. I walked over to the conductor and told him that we needed to get to Manila, and I asked him if he had any space available, and I assured him that we would be willing to stand all night because it was that urgent. And he looked at me and he said, well, I only have two seats available. I said, okay, well, you know, coincidentally, there's only two of us, so that'll work just fine, you know, if we press it. And we got onto the bus and we settled in, and as I looked at my watch, And once again, the thought occurred to me, I'm embarrassed to say, that I didn't think we were going to make it in time for me to catch my flight to Singapore. But once again, I heard him say, right in that context, Jay, I've got this. We left the gas station and we drove up into the Sierra Madre, and some of you have been in this part. There's a place called Dalton Pass on the way up to the southern part of Bucolod. And as we made our way down the other side of Dalton Pass, suddenly the bus driver pulled to a stop. and turned off the engine, which is never a good sign. We were in the middle of the road, and as I opened the curtains and I looked out the window, and I could see the highway snaking off in the distance. I don't know how many miles of highway I could see, but there were hundreds and hundreds of red lights that made their way all the way to hundreds and hundreds of white lights as far off as I could see. Hundreds of vehicles we were in one of those famous Philippine traffic jams, and we were not moving at all. Easy and light? I'm going back to, I don't think so. Okay. I checked my watch again, and I looked at the time, and I looked at the hundreds of cars in the traffic jam, and decided that the song that I had heard there in that gas station was just a coincidence, and the voice that I had heard was just my imagination, and I realized again that I was going to miss my flight. And you would have thought that God would have had something else to say about that he would have rebuked me, that he would have poked and prodded in the midst of my pain. But it was that same old, I got this, Jay, that's all. I kept staring out the window and fretting until I fell asleep and was not even conscious of the moment when the bus began to move again. And I stayed asleep until we got to San Jose. Some of you have been there. A town that's 4 hours, count them, 4 hours from Manila by bus. I checked my watch again and it was 3 a.m. And so you do the math. We wouldn't be in Manila until 7 a.m. And by the time I got to the guest house, it would be 8 a.m. And that meant that I would miss my flight. Easy and light. I've had it with that question by now. But there was God again saying, Jay, I got this. And this time I talked back to him. I said, stop saying that, God. Stop saying that you got this. Do the math. It's 4 hours from here. Manila is 4 hours from here, and that means I'll miss my flight. And then you're going to make me say it is well with my soul, and then you're going to try to convince me that because it's well with my soul, it's okay that I've missed my flight. I just want you to know that I'm on to you. That was the worshipful prayer that I exchanged with God. And so God added a little bit to it. I'm not me. Right there in my head, Jay, I got this. So put your seat back and get some sleep. Well, I was tired, so I put my seat back and I fell asleep. And I woke up just as we were pulling into Manila, and I looked at my watch, and it was 6 a.m. And to this day, I wish I'd stayed awake. I really, because I would have loved to have been there the moment that God went like that with the bus. I didn't talk to the bus driver, but I don't know how else that could have happened, how else we could have made a four-hour trip in 3 hours. But I made it in time for my breakfast appointment. I made it to the airport in time to board my flight. I made it to Singapore on time and then caught a flight a few hours later to come back here to the U.S. Easy and light? What do you think the words mean? Yeah, I got this, Jay. You know, it was remarkable that God overcame all those obstacles and got me to my flight on time despite all the mess and stress. And it occurs to me that God could have been mechanical in his approach to me by solving my problems in a different way. For example, he could have helped me to avoid hearing that the cartel was planning to shoot anyone who tried to form a co-op. Or he could have just prevented the brakes from going out the first time, right? Or he could have prompted the repair guy to do the job right so that the brakes didn't go out the second time. He could have had the gas station attendant say, well, yes, why don't you just wait? Who knows, maybe a bus will stop here. He could have said that, but God didn't provide for any of that. There are any number of things that God could have done to fix the problem just by saying the word. He could have fixed the problems or he could have prevented the problems from coming up, but that's not what he did. He chose instead to be colorful. And when he did that, he didn't just meet my needs, he eased my burden. In other words, he could have just shown up, solved my problem, and faded away, saved me all the stress in the first place. But he was more concerned about me than he was about my problem. He didn't focus on my problem. He focused on me. He didn't just solve my problem. He eased my burden. And I don't know how many other ways I can say that same, express that same truth. He wanted me to lie down in green pastures. He wanted to lead me beside the still waters. He wanted to restore my soul in the midst of the mess, not because the mess had gone away. But I wanted a quick fix. I wanted a quick fix that would make all my problems go away. But all these years later, I have to say that if he had done that, I would have missed out on one of the most precious moments I have ever had in ministry. I just wanted him to get me to Manila on time, and I came that close to missing what he really wanted to do in my life. Psalm 23:2-3, David phrased it this way. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He wanted me to rest in the midst of the mess, not because he had solved my problems, but because he had spoken to my heart. That's what he was calling for. And I wonder this morning if you've ever seen God work in your life in that way that David describes right there. Or is it possible that because you spend your time insisting that God solve your problems right now, that you weren't even aware of what he was accomplishing in your life? You weren't even aware of the fact that he was leading you to rest in the midst of the mess. Maybe we all need to just slow down a little bit and let God accomplish in our lives what he wants to accomplish. Because if we were to slow down just a little bit and pay attention, we'd know what it means to be shepherded by God. We would know what it means to know that God is more concerned about our growth. He's more concerned about our hearts than he is about our problems. And understanding that would give us insight into how to shepherd the hearts of other people that are around us. Shepherding is more than simply solving the problems that other people have. Shepherding involves helping them to solve their own problems. Psalm 23 again says it this way. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. It's very clear that David knew that his shepherd would care for him in his weariness and always, always, always lead him to rest in the midst of his turmoil. He knew that God would restore him and make his burdens easier to bear. And so we come to principle number two. If I'm a shepherd, it is because I ease the burden of the sheep. If I'm a shepherd, it's because I ease the burden of the sheep. David believed that God had his best interests at heart. David believed that God was not in any way selfish and that whatever else God might do, he would always lead him in the end to rest. We can learn from the example that God, our shepherd, has set for us as we relate to others. A lot of people face wearisome troubles every single day without anyone around them who even begins to care. And that brings me to a question. When someone you care about gets in trouble, real trouble, and you find out about it and you get involved, do things get better or do they get worse? I told you earlier to get involved and to listen to people, and I need about 5 more minutes, but I told you earlier to get involved and to listen to people, and my wife laughs at me. She laughs at me a lot, but sometimes it's for this reason. Because strangers seem oddly compelled to tell me their life story. I don't know why that is. In Walmart, on airplanes, they'll even say things like, you know, I've never told anyone this before, and I'm inclined to say, so why don't you keep your record intact and not tell me? Because probably I don't need to know this, but it doesn't work that way. And it usually starts when I ask a very innocent question. You know, how are you, I say, which, you know, I intend to mean, it's good to see you again, or it's good to meet you, but what people seem to hear is, please tell me your life story, and please don't forget to add something that you've never told anybody before. Just lay it on me. But when that starts, what happens next can be difficult to listen to, because it can get messy. Well, I've had this funny looking swelling underneath my big toenail, if you know what I mean. So I took a screwdriver and I pried on it a little, if you know what I mean. And then something started to ooze, you know, out of it, and it's ugly stuff, and if you know what I mean. And that's what I want to say. Yeah, that's too much information, and the nightmares are going to start again, if you know what I mean. I don't mean that people talk about their toenails, but it's more information. It's going to be more information than you need to hear. How many of you here this morning know that it's really dumb to pry on your toenail with a screwdriver? And three people, you guys, you are always ahead of the curve. Those same three people. It's really stupid. I mean, I know that we're not supposed to use that word, but some things just are stupid. And you might be inclined to tell him that. But rushing to point out his stupidity would prevent you from hearing the rest of the story. And no fair saying, yeah, that's what I'm trying to accomplish. I'm trying to prevent him from telling me anything else. No, no, you need to hear the story. It's important that you hear the rest of the story and that you not rush to judgment if you're going to be able to help ease his or her burden. So we're back to the question. When people close to you get in trouble and you get involved, do things get better or worse? Or worse? I've said it often, I'm not a Calvinist, I'm a Hobbesist, not a Hobbit, even though I have hairy feet. I say that because Calvin and Hobbes is my favorite cartoon. Calvin is 6 years old, if you haven't read the cartoon, I have books in my office. He's 6 years old and he has a stuffed tiger that he carries with him everywhere, and this stuffed tiger comes alive when Calvin's alone and they have these adventures. And one day Calvin lost Hobbes because a big dog came and took him away. Look at the cartoon here. Mom, a big dog knocked me down and he stole Hobbes. I tried to catch him, but I couldn't, and now I've lost my best friend. Well, Calvin, if you wouldn't bring that tiger everywhere, things like this just wouldn't happen. There is no problem so awful that a little bit of guilt can't add some guilt to it and make it worse. There's no problem so awful that you can't add some guilt to it and make it worse. And I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, Mom and Dad, but they may be in trouble. They may be in the trouble that they're in because of their own stupidity, because of their own foolishness. And there may come a time when you can point that out. But the time to point out their stupidity, however, is not in the midst of the crisis. What I'm saying is you have to make it safe to share things with you. Because when a person is facing a painful crisis, they won't add to their own burdens by talking to someone who's going to judge them. If it's not safe, they're not going to share their heart. But what if they do share their problems with you? When a person is in crisis, your primary goal ought to be to lead him or her to rest. And this brings up a question. Does your presence bring rest, or does it bring more as agitation? Sometimes your presence is the most powerful thing you can offer them. You don't necessarily have to talk. Some people have something to say, and some people just have to say something. But don't be that person who has to say something. You don't have to say something. You don't have to be profound. You don't have to be even worthwhile. If you don't have something to say, don't say anything. You don't have to say something, and you don't have to be profound. You just have to care. Remember, God is sometimes silent, but he's never absent, and his presence brings peace in the midst of our disquiet. What does your presence bring? What does my presence bring? Are they relieved to see you arrive, or are they relieved when you finally leave? Some people spread joy wherever they go. Others spread joy whenever they go. And I'll just leave that there and let you work out what that means. I'm just trying to say that a true shepherd eases the burden of the sheep. He or she does that by making it possible for the sheep to lie down in green pastures, walk beside the still waters. I know this is a sermon and I'm not supposed to get personal, but is there a time every day when you lie down in green pastures? Is there a time every day when you are led beside the still waters in the presence of your shepherd? Do you set aside time to be quiet? I'm asking that because the sheep will sometimes need to borrow from your sense of peace. Is there a deep-seated peace in your heart from which other sheep can borrow? If not, maybe you need to spend more time with your shepherd. My father-in-law used to say, if you can't sleep at night, stop counting sheep and start talking to the shepherd instead. Let the good shepherd restore your soul so that you have something to offer to others in return. So let's stop poking and prodding one another in the midst of the crisis. There'll be time for poking and prodding when the crisis is over and seeking answers to our question. And we'll have time for that as well once the crisis is passed. Because in the midst of the crisis, we don't need to be psychoanalyzed, poked, or prodded. In the midst of the crisis, what we really need is someone to make us lie down in green pastures. In the midst of the crisis, what we really need is someone to lead us beside the still waters. In the midst of the crisis, what we really need is someone to restore our souls. Principle number two, if I'm a shepherd, it's because I ease the burden of the sheep, and I'm going to leave this slide up there. The reality check, when you get involved in other people's lives, do things get better or do they get worse? And secondly, what have you done recently for your brothers and sisters to lead them to rest? Will you stand with me in the presence? Father and our God, thank you for being our shepherd. Thank you for the sweet truth that there's a quality of life that we've learned to expect because you are our shepherd and committed to caring for us. Thank you for setting the standard from which we can learn as we grow. God, I pray as we make our way out there this week that you'd help us not only to listen, but to begin to carry the burdens of other people, relieving some of the stress, relieving some of the pressure, because we've learned personally to allow you to lead us to rest. Because the Lord is my shepherd, I have everything I need. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me into paths of righteousness for his name's sake. And even though I walk through the dark valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil because you are with me. Your rod and your staff comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely, goodness, your goodness, and your love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Amen and amen. Well, we've huddled up. We know the play. I hope you're starting to care about people and that you're going to reach out to them when you see them in need. So since we've huddled up, all that's left is for me to say, ready? Go get them, Potter's House.